Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and lovely mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. It's a beautiful day here in Iowa, at last. it's so refreshing to see the sun again. I mean, you know, after days and days of gloom, it's interesting what the sun can do for your, you know, for how you feel.
Well, I just, you know, two days ago, was in Austin, Texas, where It was hot and swimming weather. And then I come back here and it was lovely the first day, but rainy. And then today it's sunny and nice and cold.
I know.
It's kind of a shock for me.
Yes, I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is.
So, Mom,
that's what they say about Iowa. You just don't like the weather. Wait 10 minutes, it'll change.
Yeah, well, Texas is the same way. So tell us who we have with us today.
Oh, today we have Catherine Burla, and she likes to write in a variety of genres, including light fantasy, contemporary literary fiction, and even horror. She is the author of the young adult novels 12 Hours in Paradise, Dream Me, The House at 758, and Going Places. The Kitty Committee, which is our novel today, is the first novel written for adult readers. Now, she grew up in India, Syria, Europe, and Asia, and Africa. And I can see why she used that in this book, and I can that experience, and I can see why. She's been an avid movie buff since childhood and often sees the movies in her head before she writes the book. She graduated from the University of California in Berkeley with a degree in English. She currently resides in the San Francisco Bay Area. So, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Monica and Caroline, for having me. This is such a thrill to be with you. And Iowa is a place that's on my bucket list to visit one day.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, let us know when you're coming, and we'll roll out the red carpet.
I will do that.
So, what got you started as a writer? Did you always want to be a writer?
I think even from the time I was a little girl, I was always writing. I would put together family newsletters, and I started writing little stories when I was quite young. I remember asking my mother if I had to adhere to the truth, and she told me it was okay to embellish a little when I was writing more or less a diary of my life. And then when she reread it, she thought, well, you embellished maybe a little bit too much. And then I thought, well, maybe I should not be writing nonfiction. Maybe I should be writing fiction. And then I started writing
or maybe your mother should not be reading your diary.
Well, I, when I say diary, it was more or less like a travel journal. And, I was seeking her advice. So it was all appreciated.
Oh, good, good.
And my mother wrote, too. So she always gave me good advice.
And did she write fiction or nonfiction?
She wrote mainly nonfiction about her travels. And she was never traditionally published, but, you know, she did write two or three books that she put together mainly for her family and for herself. So it was really from her that I learned to write, or to appreciate the fact that you could be a writer, I should say.
Well, having lived in all those different places, I'm sure there was a wealth of stories and information and things that she could write about and that you can include in your writing too, of course.
Yes, and for me as a youngster, of course, the traveling probably dealt more with my frame of mind in terms of adjustments. When you're growing up, you see traveling to different places in a whole different way than as an adult. You would see the adventure of it all. But as a child, there's issues that sometimes come along with moving that, you know, formative issues.
Yeah, you have to change schools and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right.
So the heroine of the Kitty Committee is, through most of the book, is a young teen. with a very interesting background. Do you want to tell us a little bit about her?
Yeah, her name is Grace, and she's the daughter of American missionaries, and she, like me, spent most of her life overseas living in developing countries. And then her father has a bad accident, so the family has to return to the United States. And even though she's an American, the U.S. seems like a foreign country to her. She's never really lived there. And when she gets to California and has to scramble to fit into the high school social scene, she feels completely alienated from everything and unsure of how to handle herself. So because she's so much younger and less socially aware, she joins a group of girls who seem to her like they have everything going for them. And they call themselves the Kitty Committee. And as time passes, she begins to realize that the group leader, Carly, is basically using the other girls for her own purposes, sometimes cruel, sometimes vindictive, sometimes just out of boredom. And then a new girl arrives, Jane, and when Jane arrives, Grace sees a different sort of role model because Jane is kind and accepting, and she naturally attracts others because of her innate goodness. And then Grace realizes that there's no way that Carly and Jane can coexist within the Kitty Committee, and she proves to be right, and along the way she becomes a casualty of the clash between those two girls. A casualty in the worst possible way. So it's a past and present narrative. So it's told back in time when Grace was a high school teen, and then in the present time when Grace is a woman of about 40.
So tell us how the name Kitty Committee came to be. That was interesting, I thought.
Okay. The Kitty Committee, actually, when I was younger, I had a group of friends, and we called ourselves the Kitty Committee. I have no idea why we came up with that name, but we were very nice. We had no problems. You know, we were just a group of friends. But I always thought this would just make a perfect title for a novel, and so that's why I used it. And of course, in the book, they pick the name because there's a stray cat, and they each adopt one of the kittens of the stray cat, and that's how they choose their name.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So in the past, your books have been primarily for young adult readers?
Yes. And when you say young adult books, it's a little misleading because in this day and age, young adult books are actually read just as much by adults as teens. So the actual genre, young adult, means that the protagonist has to be in their teens in high school. I usually choose 17. I don't know why. I just like that age. I think it's old enough that they can be very interesting, and yet, you know, they're still within the high school. They're not legally adults. It's in recent years, young adult has become so popular, and I find that a lot of my readers are just women in their 20s all the way up through their 60s and beyond, probably most of them in their 20s and 30s. I guess maybe those are the years when women turn more towards reading, and teens still do read a lot, but it just seems like the young adult genre has really spread into the adult world.
Well, I mean, Harry Potter was young
adult. Harry Potter started it all.
And, you know, the Twilight series and the Hunger Games and on.
Exactly. And you're saying it in the exact order that it started too.
Right. Because, and I thought I was so hip and with it because I knew about all of those before most adults did. Because either my nieces or my daughter would tell me about these books, and so I had read them all before most people my age had discovered them. But
even since I started writing, which has only been about 6 years maybe, writing and publishing, getting published, I should say, the genre has really morphed, because when in the beginning it was mindful that you were writing for high school teens, and now it just there were things that were just off limits, and now more and more things are not off limits, shall I say. It's becoming a little more mature. And of course, the librarians distinguish between young adult and more mature young adult. But
right. Now, the Kitty Committee, you know, Grace is 14, 15, 16 through most of the book.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's, and does that, but the fact that part of it is told from her adult perspective.
Makes it not young adult.
Makes it not young adult. Interesting.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
But there's a, there's a whole slew of books that are written in that type of narrative. And I've always been fascinated by past and present narrative, where an adult returns to explore their childhood, because I don't know, I just think that's a really cool idea and theme. There was a book out a couple years ago called The Girls that had that narrative, and the Elena Ferrante novels, I don't know if you're familiar with them, they take place in Naples, Italy, that has that same theme. Or Margaret Atwood wrote a book called Cat's Eye, which also has that theme. So I've always been attracted to that ever since in high school, when I read a separate piece of an adult thinking back as to momentous things that happened during their youth that has really formulated the rest of their lives and changed the adult that they became. So,
well, one advantage of that is that the teen times of the book then are set in the past, when it's a little easier for you as an adult to get all the details right of being a teen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You have the advantage of being an adult in order to interpret what it really means to you. And I like that. So, whereas if you're writing young adult and you're writing from the perspective of the teen, you're writing what's happening to you, but you don't have the 20/20 hindsight of how this is all going to affect your life going forward.
Right. And if it's set in the present time, when you're not a teen, it can be a little more challenging, I think, to get the details right of teen life at this time.
Yeah, it can. The one thing I really enjoyed, though, about the Kitty Committee and the fact that it was far in the past, say 20 years prior, is a time before kids were on social media, before they all carried cell phones. And that has really changed youth behavior, like there, or not just youth behavior, but that's changed certain devices that you can use in writing a novel, in terms of everybody knows everything nowadays.
Right.
Like, it's instantaneous. There's no possibility of misunderstanding or not getting the message, or, you know, that kind of thing. So it's just different now.
Right. And like in something like the Kitty Committee, where you've got a group, you've got at least one of the girls really is kind of a bully.
Right.
That bullying would be taking place on social media, most likely.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, it was far more complex back before social media, because it just wasn't as apparent to everyone. You know, it was more hidden. Kids still would talk about it, and it still would come to the surface. But like you said, that nowadays it would be taking place on social media as well. And social media, I think, is great for young people, but it also, you know, can be very dark too. But it freed me up a little bit in terms of the time that it took place, not having to even consider social media or cell phones, texting, and all that. But nowadays, my young adult novels, on the other hand, are set in present day so far. And so there is all of that to consider.
Right, right. So you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Catherine Burla, the author of The Kitty Committee. So was it difficult to write about, I mean, Grace is really torn by what she did and what she, you know, what, the guilt that she felt. Was it hard to you know, live in that guilty space?
It was. I don't know, like, exactly how I came to that, but, you know, I'm able to put myself into my character's head usually pretty well. And it was hard. It was a dark place to visit. And I usually write about redemption, or I'd like to write about redemption. And there's usually an aspect of that in all of my books. So I feel like Grace, just by virtue of her name, carries redemption within her, but she just has to be able to find it herself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There definitely were some twists and turns, and you do,
oh my.
You do a really good job of... of keeping us guessing about what it is that actually happened.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, yeah. It was a page turner, no doubt about it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And I, you know, I felt like Grace's guilt was more than maybe it should have. You know, she let it affect her life even more than it should have.
Yeah, you might be right. She did sabotage her life, but I feel in a way self-sabotage it, but I felt in a way that she took on Maggie's burden also. And she also felt like there was a debt that she had to repay, because of the circumstances where Jane, you know, the act that Jane committed on Grace's behalf without even thinking about it. And then when it came to Grace doing the same for Jane, she never did it. She didn't rise to the occasion. You know, she let Carly influence her. And that was the burden that she carried.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. And Mom, what were you going to say?
Oh, I don't know. I thought that Maggie, because of Maggie's physical things that happened to her, I thought she was carrying that guilt, some guilt around too.
Definitely. Yeah. Maggie was sort of like, the biblical scapegoat, you know, she took all the burdens upon herself and she suffered the most for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, another thing I found interesting was the family dynamic in Grace's family and how much that kind of impacted her, what the things that happened or her life really. And it's not that that she had bad parents, but the decisions that her parents made about her weren't really very helpful for her.
Right. And that was another area that I really was interested in exploring too. So I'm glad you mentioned that parents can be the best people in the world, but when kids feel that they're not the priority, that can derail them. So, like you said, they weren't bad parents. They felt they were doing, in their viewpoint, they were doing the best that they could. Obviously, her father had a horrible injury and was going, suffering his own demons, and her mother had to keep the family afloat.
Well, fortunately, even, she had her. Yeah, fortunately, she had her brother.
Right.
That,
exactly.
That was important. Yeah, that was important. I thought because he was a protector, and you know, wanted to be there for her.
Right. He was one of those just wonderful, solid, good people that everybody hopes they have one, at least one in their life.
Yeah, right.
So, Catherine, I'm wondering if, are there any, like, real-life incidents that kind of inspired the story or the any of these characters? Either things that are, you know, were public or even things in your own life?
Not really. I mean, I told you that the name obviously came from a group of mine, but it didn't have anything to do with the concept. But the fact that I traveled around, and when I did move back to the United States, I really had to figure out the dynamics, and it seemed like an alien world to me, even though I was an American. So that part is really what I shared in common with Grace, and was something that I've always wanted to write about. In terms of the tragedy and the bullying, fortunately, I didn't have to go through anything like that. But
that's good.
Yeah. And in terms of Grace being so much younger than her classmates by almost 2 years, my sister, who is such a brilliant woman, and because we were overseas in different schools and French schools before we moved back to the U.S., where they would advance children quickly, you know, according to intellectual capabilities rather than whether they were emotionally prepared or not. My sister was probably about 2 years younger than her classmates when we moved back to the United States. So that inspired the comparison of Grace, who
and,
was also
and did that
so
cause
younger.
Her any issues socially?
I think it was probably harder for her than for me, because at least I was among my peers. You know, I was approximately the same age as my peers, whereas my brother, younger also, my sister way younger. So they probably had a harder time of it. They were older than me.
Yeah, I was somewhat younger than most of my classmates when we moved, about the same age as Grace, but we moved from Pennsylvania to Iowa. And Pennsylvania, just the cutoff of when you could start school, you could start a little bit younger. And so I was the youngest in my class there. And so I was significantly younger than the rest of my class here, but not 2 years.
Did
it
that
was 6 months?
Do you
to
feel
eight,
that was difficult for you?
Well, the thing that made it a little tough was I was also a late bloomer physically.
Uh huh.
So, you know, I felt a little out, a little left out from that aspect. But I eventually caught up, and interestingly enough, a lot of my friends were even in. I ended up being friends with kids who were a class ahead of me. So they were 2 years older, and it was fine.
And it is interesting because we have these artificial decisions that we make for our children. Like everybody who's 12 will be in this grade, everybody who's 13. And kids are so different in terms of their emotional maturity and also just their intellectual growth. So
yeah,
these are arbitrary ages that we pick, and then the kids have to fit themselves within it. I had one son who was very young for his grade, but he was like intellectually way ahead, and I had to think, well, do I hold him or start him, or what do I do? And then another son that I decided, okay, well, I'm going to hold him, because I tried it one way and it worked out. They both worked out, but there's a lot of thought. In terms of Grace, she just was not only by years, she was so much younger, but she was just so socially awkward and she was just lost.
Yeah.
So that's why.
Yeah,
that's why she, I think, grabbed on to Carly, just because Carly was such a strong personality, and she felt like Carly would take care of her.
Well, she smiled. She was the only one that smiled at her the first day, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And that just a smile can make a big difference.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
It can.
I remember being the new kid at that age, and it is hard, you know? It's we moved when I was in ninth grade in the middle of the year across the country. And yeah, it's true. The first person who's nice to you, you sort of think, oh, I'm a friend. And yet
yeah.
they may not be the person, you know. And then actually for me, what it was that the first person who was nice to me, I'm sure was very nice. And I know she was nice, but she wasn't someone I would have become friends with normally. And so then as I made other friends, I sort of dropped her, and I always felt guilty about that.
Well, there's that's similar also to the Kitty Committee, where she has a friend, and then when she's accepted by Carly and Maggie, then she drops her friend and does feel guilty about it.
And would have been better off sticking with the friend.
Would have been so much better off.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't have had this great story. So,
so Catherine, how long do you work on a book? How long does it take you to write a book?
Well, I like to finish the first draft in about 3 months. So when I get started writing, I stick to a very disciplined schedule, and I have to write a certain amount of words every day, or I don't even allow myself to leave the house. And sometimes it happens quickly, and sometimes it takes me all day. But I like to try to finish the first draft in 3 months.
So what's your daily quota?
Well, 1,000 words is what I aim for.
Okay.
But in the end, when I'm getting close to the end, then I can just stay in and, you know, maybe do 2,000 or 3,000 words when I sense the end.
So you find it easier to write close to the end of the book?
I think just because I'm excited and I can sense, you know, the end, and I'm just excited to wrap it all up. And it just flows easier, I guess.
My question was, do you know what the ending is when you start, or is it a surprise to you too?
I actually do know the ending. So that's one thing I know in any book that I write is the ending. All the rest of it, I don't necessarily know, because I know the general plan or the general story, generally what's going to happen. But when I start writing, I find that the characters start really taking on lives of their own. And sometimes, you know, they tell me they're going to do this or they're going to do that, and I hadn't even thought of it. But I always have the ending in mind as the ultimate goal.
Does that ever change?
I've never had an ending change so far, but it could, but I haven't so far. I have 5 novels published, and I have 2 coming out in 2019. So that'll be 7. But I'm going to start writing again, I think, in this next month. I have a couple of different ideas, so I don't know which one I'll do, but
Catherine,
the 2 that are coming out in 2019 are both young adult.
Catherine, do you have all of the characters in mind when you, all the main characters, do you know who they are before you start writing, or does that kind of come through the process?
I have probably at least the main characters, but the side characters, a lot of them pop up during the process of writing. So I wouldn't say I have them all, but and then of course they flesh out, so they can become such different people than I even start with.
Mom, did you have a question?
Well, yeah, I was going to ask her to tell us about the rules of the Kitty Committee, because that was a driving force for a lot of the action. So
yeah. So in terms of their rules, they the most important rules are, the rules are really decided by Carly, even though she kind of acts mm-hmm. like everybody's in on it and everybody has a say. But really, she's the one that's formulating the rules, and she is basically trying to, what's most important for her is that they have to be the primary focus, and no one else should detract or take away from that group. In other words, Carly is ensuring that she will always have this position of power. So mm-hmm. when they say they come before, the kitty committee comes before anyone else, they're one for all and all for one. No boys should ever come between them. No one else will be ever be permitted to join them. No one is above the others, although Carly never believed that. Yeah. And if you ever leave the group, you're dead to the others. And there's also a no drugs are permitted, but alcohol is okay. All of these things are Carly's ideas and based on what serves her purposes or what her morality, if you can say that she has a morality, that's what determines the rules.
How big a role does alcohol play in what goes wrong for these girls?
Well, I think it plays it plays probably a big role in terms of clouding the good judgment at certain times, of sort of giving them an escape. And I'm not saying with Carly as much, because Carly's always in control. She always knows what she wants. But in terms of Maggie and Grace, who are self-doubt, you know, they're always doubting themselves, alcohol is a way for them maybe not to to be brave in situations where they don't feel brave, to do things that they wouldn't normally otherwise do, that Carly wants them to do, and maybe just not to have to think about what it is they are doing.
Not, and they don't consider the consequences because they're
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Catherine, would you like to read some from the Kitty Committee?
Okay. Yes, I'd love to. Let me read a passage when Grace first arrives at school on the first day of school. Mom dropped us off across the street on our first day of school. Luke flew out of the car and melded so seamlessly into the crowd it seemed he'd done it 1,000 times before. First day of school for us was February 23rd, which was going on the 160th day for everyone else. Still, I felt my chest swell with optimism at the sight of thousands of daffodils that lined every conceivable walkway around and leading up to Indian Springs High. Their humble bowing heads melded into a bright sea of such intense color, I was certain it could shame even the sun. I was Dorothy skipping along the yellow brick road towards the Emerald City and all the adventures awaiting me. An American high school, or any school of this size, was a totally unfamiliar concept to me. Prior to this, the largest school I'd attended numbered 30 students max, children of missionaries, locals, and the occasional son or daughter of an American diplomat preferring a religious education. But somewhere between my mother's car and the intimidating entrance of my new school, my legs grew heavy, my heart sodden with dread. It seemed that pixie cuts were not in style after all. I didn't see one girl with hair short enough to reveal her ears. Hair was styled, not air-dried like mine, which I had lauded for the absolute genius of convenience it would bring to my life. The source of my fashion inspiration had either been invalid or terribly out of date. I felt deceived by my mother's reassurance. How had I so badly misjudged this most basic of all teen fashion tenets, the acceptable hairstyle? But it didn't end there, because it was soon obvious the pixie cut wasn't my only fashion crime. Blouses tucked into pleated skirts were nowhere to be seen except on me. The girls wore pants, jeans mostly, tight-fitting tops revealing developing figures instead of baggy blouses. And if there were skirts, they were unlike any skirt that was part of my wardrobe, which was up until that point a mishmash of donations of used clothing from strangers, last-minute purchases from Goodwill, and some colorful ethnic fashions picked up on the cheap in countries where we'd lived. I wondered how I was going to convince Mom to let me wear makeup. Jeans, I was sure she would go along with for their modesty. I didn't have a clue as how to apply makeup, and even if I could convince Mom, she wouldn't be of any help, having never touched the stuff herself. I'd been so proud to learn I would skip a grade in my new school, but now I wondered if that was another huge mistake. It would forever mark me as the girl always at least a year less mature than her peers, and one look around told me that the physical maturity mattered here. These kids didn't seem as if they'd be wowed by my intellectual prowess. These kids held themselves as if it was what was on the outside that mattered. That was quite the opposite of what I'd been taught my entire life. I was just 13 years old and still playing with dolls.
And that's Catherine Burla reading from the fairly early in the Kitty Committee. In the, you know, the whole, kind of the whole theme of the book is about fitting in and how, and issues with self-esteem. And, you know, some people think that, that's worse today than it was 20 years ago or 40 years ago. What do you think? Do you think things have changed at all, or is it just the tools have changed, the circumstances have changed, but not the feelings?
I think that particular age, so starting with middle school and maybe going at least through the beginning of high school, are going to be those years where kids start moving away from their parents. The parents are no longer the most important influence in their life. Now the peers are the most important influence. So I think their fitting in is always going to be an issue at around that age range. But I feel like maybe, hopefully, it's better now. I think schools are becoming more aware of bullying and of kids who don't fit in being targets of bullying, and they are hopefully speaking to the students more about it. Hopefully parents are too. So I have hopes that it's getting better, but I think it will always be an issue just because kids are discovering how important their peers are, and they're moving away from the safety of parents being the center of their universe.
Yeah.
The, you know, there are probably quite a few young adult books and adult books too that sort of focus on this mean girl phenomenon. I didn't really have, you know, I didn't really feel like there were a lot of mean girls, or that was so much of a, you know, there were popular, more or less popular. And the one thing I really wish that kids could understand is that, first of all, being popular in high school isn't going to matter at all 10 years later.
And, yes.
And that having, that kids who maybe aren't popular might actually have more friends, right? More real friends than the,
yeah,
than the ones who are, and that, popular.
Yeah, and that the so-called popular kids also have their own insecurities.
Oh, absolutely.
But and that's why I don't really like the mean girl trope. I feel like in with the Kitty Committee, I tried to show that this was a case of a girl, a sociopath, Carly, and not just a typical, it wasn't because she was pretty or rich or, it was because she was actually a bad person. She was, you know, she only cared for herself and she didn't have empathy. And, Carly didn't really have friends either. I mean, she had Maggie, who basically not worshipped her, but just felt grateful to her because Carly had come to her defense and sort of protected Maggie, who was a very vulnerable, fragile personality, her whole life. So Maggie always was grateful to Carly for that, and she was very vulnerable to Carly. But Carly, other than Maggie, didn't really have friends, so she wasn't a popular girl. So, but the stories where the popular girls are just mean, you know, they're pretty or rich or whatever, they're making them popular, and they're mean. I always try to avoid that in my books, mm-hmm. and in fact, I did write a book called Dreamy, which is a young adult book where it's just assumed that the beta girl, or the alpha girl rather, I'm sorry, is going to be just this totally annoying, not very nice person. And I try to turn that on its head because everybody's a person, and even, you know, people who have things going for them in school, obvious attributes, as opposed to the not, maybe not so obvious ones that you can't see on the surface, they all have their own problems and insecurities too. So I tried to make it clear in the Kitty Committee that I tried to make it not be a typical mean girl story, more that this girl is a sociopath and she's not really a well-liked one. Most of the kids in school didn't really like her.
So, Catherine, could you read a little bit more from the Kitty Committee?
Sure. Let me see. Let me find another passage. Okay. So, again, this is more or less early in the story. After Dad's accident, he had surgery in Guatemala to stabilize him before being flown back to the States in an air ambulance. The next 2 years would mark a long, slow, painful path to recovery, but from my child-centric perspective, I didn't fully internalize what that meant for him. I knew that he rarely came out of his bedroom. I knew he slept and read and ate in a special hospital bed delivered to our home and paid for by insurance. I knew he and Mom lost the ready smiles which had carried me through childhood. I just never considered him as having to adapt in the same way that I was adapting. He was a grown-up, after all. Although our new house was the nicest one, by objective standards, that I'd ever lived in, I couldn't imagine it ever feeling like a real home. The mail continued to arrive each day, bearing the ghosts of past occupants. Dad's torment was always just yards away, dampening any bright thoughts that might percolate in my brain. Mom was mostly missing, working as a nurse in a hospital 30 miles away where, by necessity, she tended to every patient except the one who needed her most. The neighbors kept to themselves, which was a concept totally unfamiliar to me. On the positive side, we had our first TV, but it was in my parents' room to distract Dad from the pain that was his constant companion. People travel for miles to visit the daffodils that begin to bloom in Indian Springs each February. The entire town under orders to display daffodils in every conceivable space. Not exactly official orders, more a community understanding. If you don't participate, you undermine your community. Turn your back on what the word stands for. Love, acceptance, support during the hard times, judgment and ostracism. Nature's smiley faces dominate the landscape for a few months, bringing a fleeting fame to an otherwise unremarkable town. My family was one of the few that didn't live up to our obligation when we first moved to Indian Springs. Couldn't. The bulbs in front of our house were old and hadn't been well cared for. The plants had been cut back properly after blooming season. Mom was too busy taking Dad to his doc's appointments, and Luke and I were trying to adjust to our new school. Not that we would have known what to do with a daffodil, even if we'd had all the time in the world on our hands. Eventually, well-meaning neighbors showed up and replaced bulbs and tended to the ones resilient enough to survive. I'd look out the kitchen window when I was rinsing my breakfast dishes to see an unfamiliar figure, trowel in hand, hunched over the strip of bare earth that edged our front lawn. I felt keenly the divide between those happy yellow flowers that decorated our new town and the mood that permeated inside my new home.
And once again, that was Catherine Burla reading from the Kitty Committee. And you are listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline.
The daffodils appear quite frequently.
The daffodils, I guess, became, and it wasn't really my intention when I started writing, but they became, during the course of my writing, a metaphor for the perceived beauty of the community that was really all just perception and appearance, and that underneath the surface, you know, and the daffodils would die away, and then you were left with real life. And
isn't that interesting that metaphor happened accidentally?
Yeah, it did, and I don't know why. I can't even explain to you how that happened, but and then of course the letter that arrives every year always arrives during daffodil season.
Yes, and that the letter is what really drives the suspense and mystery of the story.
Yes, the letter.
Yes. Letter, email, whatever it is that they get from someone who's sort of like, I know what you did, and you're going to pay.
Right. Uh-huh.
But not, it isn't said quite so directly, so they never actually know if that's really what's being said or not. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
That's what makes it a page-turner.
So, Catherine, when you're writing, do you write, like you say you want to do 1,000 words a day, are these rough draft, first draft words do you go back and sort of revise as you're writing?
Oh, thanks. That's a great question. I actually, here's how I do it. I write the 1,000 words and I'm very, they don't just flow out of me. I labor over every sentence, every word. Sometimes, you know, even if it's the right word to express the meaning, if it doesn't sound right when I say it in my head in terms of just the flow of the sentence or the poetry of the sentence, then I'll look for a different word. And then when I'm all done, I read it over and edit it, those 1,000 words. And then the next day when I start, I read over what I wrote the day before and I edit it again.
Mm.
So now I've already edited it twice. And also labored over it. So by the time I have my rough draft finished, it's pretty well edited. I let it sit for a little while, and then I read it again with fresh eyes, the whole thing. And of course, then I make, you know, a number of changes, but not as many as you would think, because I know a lot of people have a different writing style where it just flows freely and they just let everything, you know, on the page, and then maybe don't restrain themselves as much as I do while I'm writing. So.
Right, right. It does seem like there are those two extremes in a way. People who, like you say, labor over every word in every sentence and have a pretty polished paragraph at the end of the day, you know, or paragraphs. And other people who do the stream of consciousness, regurgitate everything onto the page and then go back and chop and edit. And we've had writers do 10, 12, 15 drafts sometimes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could. It is really interesting how people are so different in the way they write. And then there are people who plot out their, you asked whether I knew what was going to happen and whether I knew the characters. I know I have a lot of author friends, and I know a lot of people who they know every character. They know everything that's going to happen. It's all outlined. Basically, all they have to do is put that outline into words, and they're done. But with me, it's not at all that way. And they call us, they say, are you a plotter or are you a pantser? pants are being writing on, from
by
the seat
of
your
pants.
Pants.
Yeah.
I'm definitely a pantser. And I feel like you have to be who you are. You know, I'm not one. There's not one way that in my mind is preferable to another. But in terms of for me, I could only be that way because my characters tell me what to write as they go along. So I couldn't outline them. I wouldn't be able to write that way. I actually have tried and it just didn't work.
Well, and some authors have said they write to discover the story.
And yeah. And that's what I would agree with
that. It
would
bore them if
they
knew the whole story before they started.
Yeah. That would be me. I would agree with that. And, I envy, people who are able to plot out their whole story. I kind of wish I could do that, but then I don't because I sort of like the thrill of discovering as I go along.
So, Catherine, how did you get your first book published? You're up to 7 now, 5 published and 2 on the way. It's probably easier than it was. So tell us a little bit about your journey to publication.
Well, it was kind of a strange journey because I sent out a query letter to get an agent just like everybody else does. And it was a book that never was published that got me my first agent and my second agent. So this book, like I said, was never published and it will never be published now, but it holds a special place in my heart. But then right soon after that, I wrote a second book and my agent fell in love with that book. And then she immediately got a publisher for it, which was Penguin Random House in Spain. And so my first book, even though I wrote it in English, was published in Spain. And
was it set in Spain?
No, it wasn't set in Spain. It was set right here where I live. But it was because this agent that I signed with, they had very strong ties in Europe. They have an office in Paris, one in London, and one in New York. And so they have a lot of connections with international scouts. And one of the international scouts just took a strong liking to the book and sold it right away to Penguin Random House in Spain. And so it's a very strange sort of backward way of breaking into the business, but that was it. So when it was first published, obviously they hired their own translator to translate the book. I was never able to read my first published book. And all the reviews that came in, I had to ask, I have a friend who lives here who's from Spain, and I had to ask her to translate everything for me because I had no idea what the reviews were saying, what the bloggers were saying, and if I had to answer anyone, I would write it in English, and then she would write it in Spanish, and then I would, you know, answer that way. So it was an odd experience.
So you couldn't do interviews either?
No, I couldn't. Well, I did written ones, but they would I would ask my friend to help me, and so I would write the answers in English.
Wow. And did that book end up being published in English later?
It did. That was The House at 758.
Wow.
And that actually was based on a incident that happened in my area of that profoundly affected me and a few people that I've known in my life. So it all came together, including my father-in-law. It all came together as a rather slim novel. It's not very long, but it could be my most personal novel, probably.
So how then did you segue into getting a U.S. publisher?
Well, by submitting, and then I wound up with Amberjack Publishing, and they, at that time, I had sort of created a backlog of books because I just kept writing. So they bought the English translation or the English version of The House at 758, and I had another couple, too. I had already written Going Places And actually, can I brag a little bit? Going Places was just in 2018 received Voya Magazine's Perfect 10. And they only give that to about maybe 20 books out of the 2,000 young adult books that they review every year. And Voya Magazine is a huge magazine for young adult or young adult librarians, school librarians.
Well, congratulations.
So it's a huge honor for me. Thanks. I'm really thrilled about that. So I had already written Going Places and Dream Me. So they bought all three of them. And then, you know, they were willing to go with the Kitty Committee. I have two coming out next year. One is with a different publisher and one is also with Amberjack. So the other publisher is Flux.
Is new to me. I see it's based in Idaho. It's an independent publisher.
Idaho and New York. They're an independent publisher, and there are a lot of independent publishers. The smaller publishers, I think, are taking on an increasingly important role, and which is really nice because it's just you're going to see more diversity in what's out there, what's offered, in terms of just.
For a long time the publishing world was going the other direction. All the independents were rolling up into two or three big companies, maybe different imprints, but they're all becoming part of Penguin and Random House,
exactly.
Macmillan, you know, and I don't even know who owns who anymore. But what is it you think that has allowed a resurgence of independent publishers?
I think it's kind of like it's more easy to understand if you look at the movie world where, you know, they're the big producers that you see all the Marvels or the sequels, you know, the big Hollywood productions. But then the indie movies are attract a lot of attention. And there are a lot of people who, like me, who prefer to see the indie movies or foreign films, which I consider almost indie movies because anything that's non-Hollywood, big Hollywood. So it's kind of like that in the book world. And I'm really glad because, like you said, all the big publishers are kind of all swallowed up into basically five. And a lot of good stuff comes out of them, obviously. But it's also nice just to have diversity and more independent thought. So my other book is coming out with Flux Publishing, and they're a really well-respected big YA indie publisher. So,
well, I'm happy to learn about Amberjack. We do a lot of books from Chronicle Books, which is a West Coast independent publisher.
Yeah, in San Francisco.
Right, and they do beautiful books.
Uh-huh.
And we're independent. We're on independent radio stations, and we definitely like to promote our independent authors and publishers.
And bookstores, too.
And bookstores.
I love independent bookstores.
Right. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, so we're on the same page.
Well, Catherine, we're out of time, and it's really been a pleasure talking to you today.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate your giving me the chance to speak to your audience.
You're very welcome. And, Mom, do you have some closing words?
Yes, I do. Experience is something you don't get until just after you need it.
Those are very wise words. I love that. You know what? I'm going to write that down right now when we hang up.
Well, thank you both.
Good.
And we'll see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Okay. Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.